He grew up next to a lake, and every morning, even in winter, Drew swam there. Now he swims in the NYU pool, but the chlorine hurts his eyes, and it's not the same, he says, with a ceiling over you. Still, he swims there a lot, especially when he's troubled, or stressed, or in a fight with Sasha.
You must have grown up swimming, he said, when he first heard you were from Florida.
And you said, of course. But the truth is, you've never liked the water. Something only Sasha knows about you. You lurch from the steps to the other end of the fire escape platform, where a window looks into the little alcove where Bix's computer lives. Bix is in front of it, dreadlocks thick as cigars, typing messages to other graduate students that they'll read on their computers, and reading messages they send back. According to Bix, this computer message sending is going to be huge, more so than the telephone. He's big on predicting the future, and you haven't really challenged him. Maybe because he's older. Maybe because he's black. Bix jumps at the sight of you, looming outside his window, in your baggy jeans and football jersey, which you've taken to wearing again, for some reason.
Shit, Rob, he says. What are you doing out there?
Watching you.
You got Lizzie all stressed out.
I'm sorry.
So come in here and tell her that.
You climb in through Bix's window. There's a Last Judgment poster hanging right over his desk, from the Albee Cathedral. You remember it from your intro to art history class last year, a class you loved so much you added art history to your business major. You wonder if Bix is religious. In the living room, Sasha and Lizzie are sitting on the futon couch, looking grim. Drew is still out on the fire escape. I'm sorry, you tell Lizzie.
It's okay,
she says. And you know you should leave it there. It's fine. Leave it alone. But some crazy engine inside you won't let you stop.
I'm sorry your mom is a bigot. I'm sorry Bix has to have a girlfriend from Texas. I'm sorry I'm an asshole. I'm sorry I make you nervous because I try to kill myself. I'm sorry to get in the way of your nice afternoon.
Your throat tightens up and your eyes get wet as you watch their faces go from stony to sad. And it's all kind of moving and sweet, except that you're not completely there. A part of you is a few feet away, or above, thinking, good, they'll forgive you. They won't desert you. And the question is, which one is really you, the one saying and doing whatever it is, or the one watching? You leave Bix and Lizzie's with Sasha and Drew, and head west, toward Washington Square. The cold spasms in the scars on your wrists. Sasha and Drew are a braid of elbows and shoulders and pockets, which presumably keeps them warmer than you. When you were back in Tampa, recovering, they took a Greyhound to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration and stayed up all night and watched the sunrise over the mall, at which point, they both say, they felt the world start to change right under their feet. You snickered when Sasha told you this, but ever since, you find yourself watching strangers' faces on the street and wondering if they feel it too. A change having to do with Bill Clinton or something even bigger that's everywhere. In the air, underground. Obvious to everyone but you. At Washington Square, you and Sasha say goodbye to Drew, who peels off to take a swim and wash the hash from his head. Sasha's wearing her backpack, heading for the library.
Thank God. You say, he's gone.
You can't seem to stop talking in two-word sentences now, even though you'd like to.
Nice, Sasha remarks. I'm kidding. He's great.
I know. Your high is wearing off, leaving a box of lint where your head should be. Getting high is new for you. Your not getting high was the whole reason Sasha picked you out the first day of freshman orientation last year. In Washington Square, blocking your sun with her henna red hair, her quick eyes looking at you from the side rather than head on.
I'm in need of a fake boyfriend, she said. Are you up for it?
How about your real one, you said. She sat down beside you and laid things out. In high school, back in L.A., she'd run away with the drummer for a band you'd never heard of, left the country, and traveled alone in Europe and Asia. Never even graduated.
Now, a freshman, she was almost 21. Her stepfather had pulled every string to get her in here. Last week, he told her he was hiring a detective to make sure she towed the line on her own in New York.
Someone could be watching me right now, she said, looking across the square, crowded with kids who all seemed to know one another. I feel like someone is.
Should I put my arm around you?
Please.
You've heard somewhere that the act of smiling makes people feel happier. Putting your arm around Sasha made you want to protect her.
Why me?
You asked. Out of curiosity.
You're cute, she said. Plus, you don't look druggy.
I'm a football player, you said. Was. You and Sasha had books to buy. You bought them together. You visited her dorm, where you caught Lizzie, her roommate, miming approval when your back was turned. At 5:30, you were both loading up your cafeteria trays, you going heavy on the spinach, because everyone says football muscle turns to jello when you stop playing. You both got your library cards, went back to your dorms, then met at the Apple for drinks at 8. It was packed with students. Sasha kept glancing around, and you figured she was thinking about the detective, so you put your arm around her and kissed the side of her face and her hair, which had a burned smell, the not-realness of it all relaxing you in a way you'd never managed to be with girls at home. At which point Sasha explained step 2. Each of you had to tell the other something that would make it impossible for you ever to really go out.
Have you done this before?
You asked, incredulous. She'd drunk 2 white wines, which you'd matched 2-1 with beers, and was starting on her 3rd.
Of course not.
So, I tell you I used to torture kitty cats, and that stops you from wanting to jump my bones?
Did you?
Fuck no.
I'll go first, Sasha said.
She'd started shoplifting at 13 with her girlfriends, hiding beaded combs and sparkly earrings inside their sleeves, seeing who could get away with more, but it was different for Sasha. It made her whole body glow. Later, at school, she'd replay each step of what had happened, counting the days until they could do it again. The other girls were nervous, competitive, and Sasha struggled not to show any more than that. In Naples, when she ran out of money, she stole things from stores and sold them to Lars, the Swede, waiting her turn on his kitchen floor with other hungry kids holding tourists' wallets, costume jewelry, American passports. They grumbled about Lars, who never gave them what they deserved. He'd played the flute in concerts back in Sweden, supposedly, but the source of that rumor might have been Lars himself. They weren't allowed beyond his kitchen, but someone had glimpsed a piano through a closing door, and Sasha often heard a baby crying. Her first time, Lars made Sasha wait longer than anyone, holding a pair of spangly platform shoes she'd swiped from a boutique. And when everyone else was paid and gone, he had squatted beside her on the kitchen floor and unbuttoned his pants. For months, she'd done business with Lars, arriving sometimes without having managed to take anything, just needing money.
I thought he was my boyfriend, she said, but I think I wasn't thinking anymore.
She was better now, hadn't stolen anything in 2 years.
That wasn't me in Naples, she told you, looking out at the crowded bar. I don't know who it was. I feel sorry for her.
And maybe from a sense that she dared you, or that anything at all could be said in the chamber of truth where you and Sasha now found yourselves, or that she'd blown out a vacuum some law of physics required you to fill. You told her about James, your teammate, how one night the two of you took out 2 girls in your pop's car, and after you'd brought them home, early, it was a game night, you and James drove to a secluded place and spent maybe an hour alone in the car. It happened just that one time, without discussion or agreement. The two of you had barely spoken after that. At times, you'd wondered if you'd made it up.
I'm not a fag, you told Sasha.
It wasn't you in the car with James. You were somewhere else, looking down, thinking, that fag is fooling around with another guy. How can he do that? How can he want it? How can he live with himself?
In the library, Sasha spends 2 hours typing a paper on Mozart's early life and sneaking sips of a Diet Coke. Being older, she feels behind. She's taking 6 courses a semester, plus summer school, so she can graduate in 3 years. She's a business/arts double major, like you, but in music. You rest your head in your arms, on the table, and sleep until she's done. Then you walk together, through the dark, to your dorm, on 3rd Avenue. You smell popcorn from the elevator. Sure enough, all 3 sweetmates are home, along with Pilar, a girl you quasi-dated last fall to distract yourself after Sasha paired off with Drew. The minute you walk in, the Nirvana volume drops and the windows fly open. You now seem to be in the same category as a professor or a cop. You make people instantly nervous. There's got to be a way to enjoy this. You follow Sasha into her room. Most students' rooms are like hamster burrows, lined with scraps and tufts of home, pillows and stuffed doggies and plug-in pots and furry slippers. But Sasha's room is practically empty. She showed up last year with nothing but a suitcase. In one corner is a rented harp she's learning to play. You lie face up on her bed while she gathers her shower bag and green kimono and goes out. She comes back quickly, not wanting to leave you alone, you have a feeling, wearing the kimono, her head in a towel. You watch from the bed as she shakes out her long hair and uses a wide-tooth comb to get the snarls out. Then she slips out of the kimono and starts getting dressed. Lacy black bra and panties, torn jeans, a faded black t-shirt, Doc Martens. Last year, after Bix and Lizzie got together, you started spending nights in Sasha's room, sleeping in Lizzie's empty bed, 3 feet away from Sasha's. You know the scar on her left ankle from a break that had to be operated on when it didn't heal right. You know the Big Dipper of reddish moles around her belly button and her mothball breath when she first wakes up. Everyone assumed you were a couple. It was that deep between you and Sasha. She would cry in her sleep, and you'd climb in her bed and hold her until her breathing got regular and slow. She felt so light in your arms. You'd fall asleep holding Sasha and wake up with a hard-on and just lie there, feeling this body you knew so well, its skin and smells alongside your own need to fuck someone, waiting for the two to merge into one impulse. Come on, pull this all together and act like someone normal for a change. But you were scared to put your lust to the test, not wanting to ruin it with Sasha if things went wrong. It was the biggest mistake of your life, not fucking Sasha. You saw this with brutal clarity when she fell in love with Drew, and it clobbered you with remorse so extreme that you thought at first you couldn't survive it. You might have held on to Sasha and become normal at the same time, but you didn't even try. You gave up the one chance God threw your way, and now it's too late. Out in the world, Sasha would grab your hand or throw her arms around you and kiss you. That was for the detective. He could be anywhere, watching you toss snowballs in Washington Square, Sasha jumping onto your back, her fluffy mittens leaving fibers on your tongue. He was the invisible companion you saluted over bowls of steamed vegetables at Dojo.
I want him to see me eating healthy food, she said.
Occasionally, you raised practical questions about the detective. Had her stepfather mentioned him again? Did she know for certain it was a man? How long did she think the surveillance would last? But this line of thinking seemed to irritate Sasha, so you let it go.
I want him to know I'm happy, she said. I want him to see me well again, how I'm still normal, even after everything.
And you wanted that too. When she met Drew, Sasha forgot about the detective. Drew is detective proof. Even her stepfather likes him. It's after 10 by the time you and Sasha meet up with Drew on 3rd Avenue and 8th Street. His eyes are bloodshot from swimming. His hair is wet. He kisses Sasha like they've been apart for a week.
My older woman, he calls her sometimes,
and loves the fact that she's been on her own in the wider world. Of course, Drew knows nothing about how bad things were for Sasha in Naples, and lately you have the feeling she's starting to forget, begin over again as the person she is to Drew. This makes you sick with envy. Why couldn't you do that for Sasha? Who's gonna do it for you? On East 7th, you pass Bix and Lizzie's, but the lights are off. Lizzie is out with her parents. The streets are full of people, most of whom seem to be laughing, and you wonder again about that change Sasha felt when the sun rose in Washington, D.C., whether these people feel it, too, and their laughter comes from that. On Avenue A, the three of you stand outside the Pyramid Club, listening.
Still the second band,
Sasha says. So you walk up the street for egg creams at the Russian newsstand and drink them on a bench in Tompkins Square Park, which just reopened last summer. Look, you say, opening your hand. Three yellow pills. Sasha sighs. She's running out of patience.
What are they?
Drew asks. E. He has an optimist's attraction to everything new, a faith that it will enrich him, not hurt him. Lately you found yourself using this quality in Drew, scattering breadcrumbs for him one by one.
I want to do it with you, he tells Sasha,
but she shakes her head.
I missed your druggy moment,
he says wistfully.
Thank God, Sasha says.
You pop one of the pills and put the other two back in your pocket. You start to feel the E as soon as you enter the club. The Pyramid is jammed. The Conduits have been big on college campuses for years, but Sasha's convinced their new album is pure genius and will go multi-platinum. She likes to get right up against the stage, the band in her face, but you need more distance. Drew stays close to Sasha, but when the Conduits' nutcase of a lead guitarist, Bosco, starts flinging himself around like a berserk scarecrow, you notice him edging back. You've entered a state of tingling, stomachy happiness that feels the way you hoped adulthood would be as a kid. A blur of lost bearings, release from the drone of meals and homework and church, and, that's not a nice way to talk to your sister, Robert Jr. You wanted a brother. You want Drew to be your brother. Then you could have built the log cabin together and slept inside it, snow piling up outside the windows. You could have slaughtered the elk and, afterward, slick with blood and fur, peeled off your clothes together beside a bonfire. If you could see Drew naked, even just once, it would ease a deep, awful pressure inside you. Bosco's getting tossed over your head, his shirt gone, skinny torso slimed with beer and sweat. Your hands slip over the flinty muscles of his back. He's still playing his guitar, hollering without a microphone. Drew spots you and moves closer, shaking his head. He'd never been to a concert before he met Sasha. You shimmy one of the remaining yellow pills from your pocket and push it into his hand. Something was funny a while ago, but you can't remember what. Drew doesn't seem to know either, although you're both convulsed with helpless hysterics. Sasha thought you would wait for her inside after the show, so it takes her a while to find the two of you out on the pavement. Her eyes move between you in the acid streetlight.
Ah,
she says.
I get it. Don't be mad,
Drew says. He's trying not to look at you. If you look at each other, you're gone. But you can't stop looking at Drew.
I'm not mad, Sasha says. I'm bored.
She got introduced to the Conduits producer, Benny Salazar, and he's invited her to a party.
I thought we could all go,
she tells Drew,
but you're too high.
He doesn't want to go with you, you bellow, your nose running with laughter and snot. He wants to come with me.
That's true,
Drew says.
Fine, Sasha says angrily. Then everyone's happy.
The two of you reel away from her. Hilarity keeps you busy for several blocks, but there's a sickness to it, like an itch that if you keep on scratching, will grind straight through skin and muscle and bone, shredding your heart. At one point, you both have to stop walking and sit on a stoop, leaning against each other, half sobbing. You buy a gallon of orange juice and guzzle it on a corner, juice gushing over both your chins and soaking your puffy jackets. You hold the carton upside down above your mouth, catching the last drops in the back of your throat, When you toss it away, the city rises darkly around you. You're on 2nd Street and Avenue B. People are exchanging little vials in their handshakes. But Drew stretches out his arms, feeling the E in his fingertips. You've never seen him afraid, only curious. I feel bad, you say, about Sasha.
Don't worry, Drew says. She'll forgive us.
After your wrists had been stitched and bandaged, and someone else's blood had been pumped inside you, and your parents were waiting at the Tampa airport for the first flight out, Sasha pushed aside the IV coils and climbed into your bed at St. Vincent's. Even through the painkillers, there was a thudding ache around your wrists.
Bobby,
she whispered. Her face was almost touching yours. She was breathing your breath, and you were breathing hers, malty from fear and lack of sleep. It was Sasha who found you. 10 more minutes, they said.
Bobby, listen to me.
You opened your eyes, and Sasha's green eyes were right up against them, your lashes interlocking.
In Naples, she said, there were kids who were just lost. You knew they were never going to get back to what they'd been or have a normal life. And then there were other ones who you thought, maybe they will.
You tried to ask which kind Lars the Swede was, but it came out a mush.
Listen,
she said.
Bobby, in a minute, they're gonna kick me out.
You opened your eyes, but you hadn't realized were shut.
What I'm saying is, we're the survivors,
Sasha said. She spoke in a way that briefly cleared your head of the cloudy things they were pumping inside you, like she'd opened an envelope and read a result that you urgently needed to know. Like you'd been caught off sides and had to be straightened out.
Not everyone is, but we are, okay?
Okay. She lay alongside you, every part of you touching, like you'd done so many nights before she met Drew. You felt Sasha's strength seeping into your skin. You tried to hold her, but your hands were stuffed animal stumps, and you couldn't move them.
Which means you can't do that again, she said. Ever, 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 ever. Do you promise me, Bobby?
I promise. And you meant it. You wouldn't break a promise to Sasha.
Bix!
Drew shouts. He charges up Avenue B, boots clobbering the pavement. Bix is alone, hands in the pockets of his green army jacket.
Whoa!
He says, laughing when he sees from Drew's eyes how high he is. Your own high is just beginning to waver. You'd been planning to take that last pill, but you offer it to Bix instead.
I don't really do this anymore,
Bix says.
But rules are for bending, right?
A custodian made him leave the lab. He's been walking around for 2 hours. And Lizzie's asleep, you say, in your apartment. Bix gives you a cold look that empties your good mood.
Let's not get started on that,
he says. You walk together, waiting for Bix to come onto the E. It's after 2 a.m., the hour when, it turns out, regular people go home to bed, and drunk, crazy, fucked up people stay out. You don't want to be with those people. You want to go back to your suite and knock on Sasha's door, which she leaves unlocked when Drew isn't spending the night.
Earth to Rob,
Bix says. His face is soft, and his eyes are shiny and bewitched. I was thinking I might go home, you say.
You can't,
Bix cries. Love for his fellow creatures radiates from within him like an aura. You can feel its glow on your skin.
You're central to the action.
Right, you mutter. Drew slings his arm around you. He smells like Wisconsin. Woods, fires, ponds. Although you've never been near it.
Truth, Rob,
he says, serious.
You're our aching, pounding heart.
You wind up at an after-hours club Bix knows about on Ludlow, crowded with people too high to go home. You all dance together, subdividing the space between now and tomorrow until time seems to move backward. You share a strong joint with a girl whose bangs are very short, leaving her bright forehead exposed. She dances near you, her arms around your neck, and Drew shouts in your ear over the music.
She wants to go home with you, Rob.
But eventually, the girl gives up, or forgets, or you forget, and she disappears. The sky is just getting light when the three of you leave the club. You walk north together, to Leshko's on Avenue A, for scrambled eggs and piles of fried potatoes, then stagger, stuffed, back onto the groggy street. Bix is between you and Drew, one arm around each of you. Fire escapes dangle off the sides of buildings. A croupy church bell starts up, and you remember, it's Sunday. Someone seems to be leading the way toward the 6th Street overpass to the East River, but really, you're all moving in tandem, like on a Ouija board. The sun blazes into view, spinning bright and metallic against your eyeballs, ionizing the water's surface so you can't see a bit of pollution or crud underneath. It looks mystical, biblical. It raises a lump in your throat. Bix squeezes your shoulder.
Gentlemen, he says, good morning.
You stand together at the river's edge, looking out, the last patches of old snow piled at your feet.
Look at that water, Drew says. I wish I could swim in it.
After a minute, he says,
let's remember this day, even when we don't know each other anymore.
You look over at Drew, squinting in the sun, and for a second, the future tunnels out in a way, some version of you at the end of it, looking back. And right then you feel it. What you've seen in people's faces on the street, a swell of movement, like an undertow, rushing you towards something you can't quite see.
Aw, we'll know each other forever,
Bix says.
The days of losing touch are almost gone. What does that mean?
Drew asks.
We're going to meet again, in a different place,
Bix says.
Everyone we've lost, we'll find. Or they'll find us.
Where?
How?
Drew asks. Bix hesitates, like he's held the secret so long he's afraid of what will happen when he releases it into the air.
I picture it like a judgment day,
he says finally, his eyes on the water.
We'll rise up out of our bodies and find each other again, in spirit form. We'll meet in that new place, all of us together.
And first, it'll seem strange.
And pretty soon it'll seem strange that you could ever lose someone or get lost.
Bix knows, you think. He's always known, in front of that computer, and now he's passing the knowledge on. But what you say is, will you finally get to meet Lizzie's parents? The surprise lands cleanly in Bix's face, and he laughs a big, billowing noise.
I don't know, Rob,
he says, shaking his head.
Maybe not. Maybe that part will never change. But I like to think so.
He rubs his eyes, which look suddenly tired, and says,
speaking of which, time to head back home.
He walks away, hands in the pockets of his army jacket, but it's a while before it feels like he's really gone. You pull your last joint from your wallet and smoke it with Drew, walking south. The river is quiet, no boats in sight. A couple of toothless geezers fishing under the Williamsburg Bridge. Drew, you say? He's looking at the water with that stone distraction that makes anything seem worth studying. You laugh nervous, and he turns.
What?
I wish we could live in that cabin. You and me.
What cabin?
The one you built, in Wisconsin. You see confusion in Drew's face, and you add, if there is a cabin...
Of course there's a cabin.
Your high granulates the air, then Drew's face, which reconstitutes with a new wariness in it that frightens you.
I would miss Sasha,
he says, slowly.
Wouldn't you?
You don't really know her, you say, breathless, a little desperate. You don't know who you'd be missing. A massive storage hangar has intervened between the path and the river, and you walk alongside it.
What don't I know about Sasha?
Drew asks, in his usual friendly tone, but it's different. You sense him already turning away, and you start to panic. She was a hooker, you say. A hooker and a thief. That's how she survived in Naples. As you speak these words, a howling starts up in your ears. Drew stops walking. You're sure he's gonna hit you, and you wait for it.
That's insane, he says, and fuck you for saying it.
Ask her, you shout, to be heard above the howling. Ask about Lars the Swede, who used to play the flute. Drew starts walking again,
his head down. You walk beside him, your steps narrating your panic. What have you done? What have you done? What have you done? What have you done? The FDR is over your heads, tires roaring, gasoline in your lungs. Drew stops again. He looks at you through the dim, oily air like he's never seen you before.
Wow, Rob,
he says.
You are really and truly an asshole.
You're the last to know.
Not me, Sasha.
He turns and walks quickly away, leaving you alone. You charge after him, seized by a wild conviction that containing Drew will seal off the damage you've done. She doesn't know, you tell yourself. She still doesn't know. As long as Drew is in sight, she doesn't know. You stalk him along the river's edge, maybe 20 feet between you, half running to keep up. He turns once.
Go away. I don't want to be near you.
But you sense his confusion about where to go, what to do, and it reassures you. Nothing has happened yet. Between the Manhattan and Brooklyn bridges, Drew stops beside what might be called a beach. It's made entirely out of garbage, old tires, trash, splintered wood, and glass and filthy paper and old plastic bags tapering gradually into the East River. Drew stands on this rubble looking out, and you wait a few feet behind him. Then he begins to undress. You don't believe it's happening at first. Off comes his jacket, his sweater, his two t-shirts and undershirt. And there is Drew's bare torso, strong and tight as you'd imagined, though thinner, the dark hair on his chest in the shape of a spade. In jeans and boots, Drew picks his way to where garbage and water meet. An angular slab of concrete juts out, the failed foundation of something long forgotten, and he scrambles on top of it. He unlaces his boots and removes them, then kicks off his jeans and boxers. Even through your dread, you feel a faint appreciation for the beauty and inelegance of a man undressing. He glances back at you, and you glimpse his naked front, the dark pubic hair and strong legs.
I've always wanted to do this, he says in a flat voice, and takes a long, leaping, shallow dive, slamming the East River's surface and letting out something between a scream and a gasp.
He surfaces, and you hear him trying to catch his breath. It can't be more than 45 degrees out. You climb the slab of concrete and start taking off clothes, sodden with dread, but moved by a wavering sense that if you can master this dread, it will mean something, prove something about you. Your scars twang in the cold. Your dick has shriveled to the size of a walnut, and your football bulk is starting to slide, but Drew isn't even watching you. He's swimming, strong, clear swimmer's strokes. You make a clumsy leap, your body crashing onto the water, your knee hitting something hard under the surface. The cold locks in around you, knocking out your breath. You swim crazily to get away from the garbage, which you picture underneath, rusty hooks and claws reaching up to slash your genitals and feet. Your knee aches from whatever it hit. You lift up your head and see Drew floating on his back.
We can get back out of here, right?
You yell.
Yes, Rob, he answers in that new flat voice. Same way we got in.
You don't say anything else. It takes all your strength to tread water and yank in breath. Eventually, without your noticing, the cold begins to feel almost tropically warm against your skin. The shrieking in your ears subsides, and you can breathe again. You look around, startled by the mythic beauty of what surrounds you. Water encircling an island. A distant tugboat jutting out its rubbery lip. The Statue of Liberty. A thunder of wheels on the Brooklyn Bridge, which looks like the inside of a harp. Church bells, meandering and off-key, like the chimes your mother hangs on the porch. You're moving fast, and when you look for Drew, you can't find him. The shore is far away. A person is swimming near it, but at such a distance that when the swimmer pauses, waving frantic arms, you can't see who it is. You hear a faint shout, Rob, and realize you've been hearing that voice for a while. Panic scissors through you, bringing crystalline engagement with physical facts. You're caught in a current. There are currents in this river. You knew that, heard it somewhere and forgot. You shout,
but feel the smallness of your voice, the seismic indifference of the water around you, all this in an instant.
Help! Drew!
As you flail, knowing you're not supposed to panic, panicking will drain your strength. Your mind pulls away, as it does so easily, so often, without your even noticing sometimes, leaving Robert Freeman Jr. to manage the current alone while you withdraw to the broader landscape, the water and buildings and streets, the avenues like endless hallways, your dorm full of sleeping students, the air thick with their communal breath. You slip through Sasha's open window, floating over the sill lined with artifacts from her travels, a white seashell, a small gold pagoda, a pair of red dice, her harp in one corner with its small wood stool. She's asleep in her narrow bed, her burned red hair dark against the sheets. You kneel beside her, breathing the familiar smell of Sasha's sleep, whispering into her ear some mix of, "I'm sorry," and "I believe in you," and "I'll always be near you, protecting you," and "I will never leave you. I'll be curled around your heart for the rest of your life," until the water pressing my shoulders and chest crushes me awake, and I hear Sasha screaming into my face, "Fight! Fight! Fight!"
Chapter 11. Goodbye, my love. When Ted Hollander first agreed to travel to Naples in search of his missing niece, he drew up for his brother-in-law, who was footing the bill, a plan for finding her that involved cruising the places where aimless, strung-out youths tended to congregate, the train station, for example, and asking if they knew her.
"Sasha, American. Capelli rossi,"
red hair, he'd planned to say, had even practiced his pronunciation until he could roll the R in front of rossi to perfection. But since arriving in Naples a week ago, he hadn't said it once. Today, he ignored his resolve to begin looking for Sasha and visited the ruins of Pompeii, observing early Roman wall paintings and small, prone bodies scattered like Easter eggs among the columned courtyards. He ate a can of tuna under an olive tree and listened to the crazy, empty silence. In the early evening, he returned to his hotel room, heaved his aching body onto the king-sized bed, and phoned his sister, Beth, Sasha's mother, to report that another day's efforts had been unsuccessful.
"Okay," Beth sighed from Los Angeles, as she did each afternoon.
The energy of her disappointment endowed it with something like consciousness. Ted experienced it as a third presence on the phone.
"I'm sorry," he said.
A drop of poison filled his heart. He would look for Sasha tomorrow. Yet even as he made this vow, he was reaffirming a contradictory plan to visit the Museo Nazionale, home of an Orpheus and Eurydice he'd admired for years, a Roman marble relief copied from a Greek original. He had always wanted to see it. Mercifully, Hammer, Beth's second husband, who normally had a volley of questions for Ted that boiled down to one very simple question, "Am I getting my money's worth?" thus filling Ted with truant anxiety, either wasn't around or chose not to weigh in. After hanging up, Ted went to the minibar and dumped a vodka over ice. He brought drink and phone to the balcony and sat in a white plastic chair, looking down at the Via Partenope and the Bay of Naples. The shore was craggy, the water of questionable purity, though arrestingly blue, and those game Neapolitans, most of whom seemed to be fat, were disrobing on the rocks and leaping into the bay in full view of pedestrians, tourist hotels, and traffic. He dialed his wife.
"Oh, hi, hon."
Susan was startled to hear from him so early in the day. Usually he called closer to dinner time.
"Is everything okay?"
Everything's fine.
Already her brisk, merry tone had disheartened him. Susan was often on Ted's mind in Naples, but a slightly different version of Susan. A thoughtful, knowing woman with whom he could speak without speaking. It was this slightly different version of Susan who had listened with him to the quiet of Pompeii, alert to lingering reverberations of screams, of sliding ash. How could so much devastation have been silenced? This was the sort of question that had come to preoccupy Ted in his week of solitude, a week that felt like both a month and a minute.
"I've got a nibble on the Suskind house," Susan said,
apparently hoping to cheer him with this dispatch from the realm of real estate. Yet each disappointment Ted felt in his wife, each incremental deflation, was accompanied by a seizure of guilt. Many years ago, he had taken the passion he felt for Susan and folded it in half, so he no longer had a drowning, helpless feeling when he glimpsed her beside him in bed, her ropey arms and soft, generous ass. Then he'd folded it in half again, so when he felt desire for Susan, it no longer brought with it an edgy terror of never being satisfied. Then in half again, so that feeling desire entailed no immediate need to act. Then in half again, so he hardly felt it. His desire was so small in the end that Ted could slip it inside his desk or a pocket and forget about it, and this gave him a feeling of safety and accomplishment, of having dismantled a perilous apparatus that might have crushed them both. Susan was baffled at first, then distraught. She'd hit him twice across the face. She'd run from the house in a thunderstorm and slept at a motel. She'd wrestled Ted to the bedroom floor in a pair of black crotchless underpants. But eventually, a sort of amnesia had overtaken Susan. Her rebellion and hurt had melted away, deliquesced into a sweet, eternal sunniness that was terrible in the way that life would be terrible, Ted supposed, without death to give it shape and gravitas. He'd presumed at first that her relentless cheer was mocking, another phase in her rebellion, until it came to him that Susan had forgotten how things were between them before Ted began to fold up his desire. She'd forgotten and was happy, had never not been happy, and while all of this bolstered his awe at the gymnastic adaptability of the human mind, it also made him feel that his wife had been brainwashed. By him.
"Han," Susan said, "Alfred wants to talk to you."
Ted braced himself for his moody, unpredictable son.
"Hiya, Alf."
"Dad, don't use that voice."
"What voice?"
"That fake dad voice."
"What do you want from me, Alfred? Can we have a conversation?"
"We lost."
"So you're what, 5 and 8?
4 and 9.
"Well, there's time."
"There's no time," said Alfred. "Time is running out."
"Is your mother still there?"
Ted asked, a bit desperately.
"Can you put her back on?"
"Miles wants to talk to you."
Ted spoke with his two other sons, who had further scores to report. He felt like a bookie. They played every sport imaginable, and some that, to Ted, were not. Soccer, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, basketball, football, fencing, wrestling, tennis, skateboarding, not a sport, golf, ping pong, video voodoo, absolutely not a sport and Ted refused to sanction it, rock climbing, rollerblading, bungee jumping, Miles, his oldest, in whom Ted sensed a joyous will to self-destruct, backgammon, not a sport, volleyball, wiffle ball, rugby, cricket, what country was this? Squash, water polo, ballet, Alfred, of course, and most recently, taekwondo. At times, it seemed to Ted that his sons took up sports merely to ensure his presence beside the greatest possible array of playing surfaces. And he duly appeared, hollering away his voice among piles of dead leaves and the tang of wood smoke in fall, among iridescent clover in spring, and through the soggy, mosquito-flecked summers of upstate New York. After speaking to his wife and boys, Ted felt drunk, anxious to get out of the hotel. He seldom drank. Booze flung a curtain of exhaustion over his head, robbing him of the two precious hours he had each night, two, maybe three, after dinner with Susan and the boys, in which to think and write about art. Ideally, he should have been thinking and writing about art at all times, but a confluence of factors made such thinking and writing both unnecessary — he was tenured at a third-rate college with little pressure to publish — and impossible. He taught three art history courses a semester and had taken on vast administrative duties. He needed money. The site of his thinking and writing was a small office wedged in one corner of his shaggy house, on whose door he'd installed a lock to keep his sons out. They gathered wistfully outside it, his boys, with their chipped, heartbreaking faces. They were not permitted to so much as knock upon the door to the room in which he thought and wrote about art, but Ted hadn't found a way to keep them from prowling outside it. Ghostly, feral creatures drinking from a pond in moonlight, their bare feet digging at the carpet, their fingers sweating on the walls, leaving spores of grease that Ted would point out each week to Elsa, the cleaning woman. He would sit in his office, listening to the movements of his boys, imagining that he felt their hot, curious breath. "I will not let them in," he would tell himself. "I will sit and think about art." But he found, to his despair, that often he couldn't think about art. He thought about nothing at all. At dusk, Ted strolled up the Via Partenope to the Piazza Vittoria. It was teeming with families, kids punting the ubiquitous soccer balls, exchanging salvos of ear-splitting Italian. But there was another presence, too, in the fading light: the aimless, unclean, vaguely threatening youths who trolled this city where unemployment was at 33%, members of a disenfranchised generation who slunk around the decrepit palazzi where their 15th-century forebears had lived in splendor, who shot dope on the steps of churches in whose crypts those same forebears now lay, their diminutive coffins stacked like cordwood. Ted shrank from these youths, though he was 6'4" and weighed in at 230, with a face that looked innocuous enough in the bathroom mirror, but often prompted colleagues to ask him what was the matter. He was afraid Sasha would be among these kids, that it was she, eyeing him through the jaundiced streetlight that permeated Naples after dark. He'd emptied his wallet of all but one credit card and minimal cash. He left the piazza quickly in search of a restaurant. Sasha had disappeared 2 years ago, at 17. Disappeared like her father, Andy Grady, a berserk financier with violet eyes who'd walked away from a bad business deal a year after his divorce from Beth and hadn't been heard from again. Sasha had resurfaced periodically, requesting money wires in several far-flung locales, and twice Beth and Hammer had flown wherever it was and tried in vain to intercept her. Sasha had fled an adolescence whose catalog of woes had included drug use, countless arrests for shoplifting, a fondness for keeping company with rock musicians, Beth reported helplessly, 4 shrinks, family therapy, group therapy, and 3 suicide attempts. All of which Ted had witnessed from afar with a horror that gradually affixed to Sasha herself. As a little girl, she'd been lovely, bewitching even. He remembered this from a summer he'd spent with Beth and Andy in their house on Lake Michigan. But she'd metamorphosed into a glowering presence at the occasional Christmas or Thanksgiving when Ted saw her, and he'd steered his boys away, afraid her self-immolation would somehow taint them. He wanted nothing to do with Sasha. She was lost. Ted rose early the next morning and took a taxi to the Museo Nazionale, cool, echoey, empty of tourists, despite the fact that it was summer. He drifted among dusty busts of Hadrian and the various Caesars, experiencing a physical quickening in the presence of so much marble that verged on the erotic. He sensed the proximity of the Orpheus and Eurydice before he saw it, felt its cool weight across the room, but prolonged the time before he faced it, reminding himself of the events leading up to the moment it described. Orpheus and Eurydice in love and newly married. Eurydice dying of a snake bite while fleeing the advances of a shepherd. Orpheus descending to the underworld, filling its dank corridors with music from his lyre as he sang of his longing for his wife. Pluto granting Eurydice's release from death on the sole condition that Orpheus not look back at her during their ascent. And then, the hapless instant when, out of fear for his bride as she stumbled in the passage, Orpheus forgot himself and turned. Ted stepped toward the relief. He felt as if he'd walked inside it, so completely did it enclose and affect him. It was the moment before Eurydice must descend to the underworld a second time, when she and Orpheus are saying goodbye. What moved Ted, mashed some delicate glassware in his chest, was the quiet of their interaction, the absence of drama or tears as they gazed at each other, touching gently. He sensed between them an understanding too deep to articulate, the unspeakable knowledge that everything is lost. Ted stared at the relief, transfixed, for 30 minutes. He walked away and returned. He left the room and came back. Each time the sensation awaited him, a fibrillating excitement such as he hadn't felt for years in response to a work of art, compounded by further excitement that such excitement was still possible. He spent the rest of the day upstairs among the Pompeian mosaics, but his mind never left the Orpheus and Eurydice. He visited it again before leaving the museum. By now it was afternoon. Ted began to walk, still dazed, until he found himself among a skein of backstreets so narrow they felt dark. He passed churches, blistered with grime, moldering palazzi, whose squalid interiors leaked sounds of wailing cats and children. Soiled, forgotten coats of arms tilted above their massive doorways, and these unsettled Ted. Such universal, defining symbols made meaningless by nothing more than time. He imagined the slightly different version of Susan beside him, sharing his wonderment. As the Orpheus and Eurydice relaxed its hold, Ted became aware of a subterranean patter around him, an interplay of glances, whistles, and signals that seemed to include nearly everyone, from the crone draped in black outside the church, to the kid in the green t-shirt who kept buzzing past Ted on his Vespa, grazingly close, everyone but himself. From a window, an old woman was using a rope to lower a basket full of Marlboro packs to the street. Black market, Ted thought, watching uneasily as a girl with tangled hair and sunburned arms removed a packet of cigarettes and placed some coins in the basket. As it swung upward again, toward the window, Ted recognized the cigarette buyer as his niece. So acutely had he been dreading this encounter that he felt no real surprise at the staggering coincidence of its actually taking place. Sasha lit one of the Marlboros, brow creased, and Ted slowed his pace, pretending to admire the greasy wall of a palazzo. When she began walking again, he followed. She wore faded black jeans and a dishwater gray t-shirt. She walked erratically and with a slight limp, slowly, then briskly, so that Ted had to concentrate in order not to overtake her or fall behind. He was sliding into the city's knotty entrails, a poor, untouristed area where the sound of flapping laundry mingled with the bristly chatter of pigeons' wings. Without warning, Sasha pivoted around to face him. She stared, bewildered, into his face. "Is that," she stammered, "Uncle?"
"My God," Sasha!
Ted cried, wildly mugging surprise. He was a lousy fake. You scared me, Sasha said, still disbelieving. I felt someone...
You scared me, too,
Ted rejoined, and they laughed nervous. He should have hugged her right away. Now it felt too late. To fend off the obvious question, what was he doing in Naples, Ted kept talking. Where was she going?
To visit friends, Sasha said. What about you?
Just walking,
he said, too loudly. They had fallen into step.
Is that a limp?
I broke my ankle in Tangiers, she said. I fell down a long flight of steps.
I hope you saw a doctor.
Sasha gave him a pitying look. I wore a cast for 3.5 months.
Then why the limp?
I'm not sure. She had grown up, and so uncompromising was this adulthood, so unstinting its inventory of breasts and hips and gently indented waist, the expert flicking away of her cigarette and whispery creases alongside her eyes, that Ted experienced the change as instantaneous. A miracle. Her hair was not nearly as red as it had been. Her face was fragile and mischievous, pale enough to absorb hues from the world around her, purple, green, pink, like a face painted by Lucian Freud. She looked like a girl who a century ago would not have lived long, would have died in childbirth. A girl whose feathery bones did not quite heal.
You live here?
He asked.
Naples?
A nicer part, Sasha said, with a tinge of snobbery.
What about you, Uncle Teddy? Do you still live in Mount Gray, New York? I do, he said, startled by her recall.
Is your house very big? Are there lots of trees? Do you have a tire swing?
Trees galore. A hammock no one uses.
Sasha paused, closing her eyes as if to imagine it. You have 3 sons, she said. Miles, Ames, and Alfred. She was right. Even the order was right.
I'm amazed you remember,
Ted said. I remember everything, Sasha said. She had stopped before one of the seedy palazzi, its coat of arms painted over with a yellow smiley face that Ted found macabre. This is where my friends live, she said. Goodbye, Uncle Teddy. It was so nice running into you. She shook his hand with damp, spidery fingers. Ted, unprepared for this abrupt parting, stammered a little.
Wait, but can I take you to dinner?
Sasha tilted her head, searching his eyes. I'm awfully busy, she said, with apology. Then, as if softened by some deep, unfailing will to politeness, but yes, I'm free tonight. It was only as Ted pushed open the door to his hotel room, the medley of 1950s beige tones that had greeted him after each day he'd spent not looking for Sasha, that he was rocked by the sheer outlandishness of what had just happened. It was time to make his daily call to Beth, and he imagined his sister's dumbstruck jubilation at the landslide of good news since yesterday. Not only had he located her daughter, but Sasha had seemed clean, reasonably healthy, mentally coherent, and in possession of friends. In short, better than they'd had any right to expect. And yet, Ted felt no such joy. Why? He wondered, lying flat on the bed with arms crossed, shutting his eyes. Why this longing for yesterday, even this morning, for the relative peace of knowing he should look for Sasha but failing to do so? He didn't know. He didn't know. Beth and Andy's marriage had died spectacularly the summer Ted lived with them on Lake Michigan while managing a construction site 2 miles farther up the lake. Apart from the marriage itself, the casualties by summer's end included the majolica plate Ted had given Beth for her birthday, sundry items of damaged furniture, Beth's left shoulder, which Andy dislocated twice, and her collarbone, which he broke. When they fought, Ted would take Sasha outside, through the razor-edged grass, to the beach. She had long red hair and blue-white skin that Beth was always trying to keep from burning. Ted took his sister's worries seriously and always brought the sunscreen with him when they went out to the sand, sand that was too hot in the late afternoons for Sasha to walk on without screaming. He would carry her in his arms, light as a cat in her red and white two-piece, set her on a towel, and rub cream onto her shoulders and back and face, her tiny nose, she must have been 5, and wonder what would become of her, growing up amid so much violence. He insisted she wear her white sailor hat in the sun, though she didn't want to. He was a graduate student in art history, working as a contractor to pay his tuition.
"A contractor," Sasha repeated, fastidiously. "What's that?"
"Well, he organizes different workmen to build a house."
"Are there floor sanders?"
"Sure. You know any floor sanders?"
"One," she said. "He sanded floors in our house. His name is Mark Avery."
Ted was instantly suspicious of this Mark Avery.
"He gave me a fish," Sasha offered.
"A goldfish?"
"No,"
she said, laughing, swatting his arm.
"A bathtub fish."
"Does it squeak?"
"Yes, but I don't like the sound."
These conversations went on for hours. Ted had the uneasy sense that the child was spinning them out as a way of filling the time, distracting them both from whatever was going on inside that house. And this made her seem much older than she really was, a tiny little woman, knowing, world-weary, too accepting of life's burdens even to mention them. She never once alluded to her parents or to what it was she and Ted were hiding from out on that beach.
"Will you take me swimming?"
"Of course,"
he always said. Only then would he allow her to doff her protective cap. Her hair was long and silken. It blew in his face when he carried her, as she always wished, into Lake Michigan. She would gird him with her thin legs and arms, warm from the sun, and rest her head on his shoulder. Ted sensed her mounting dread as they approached the water, but she refused to let him turn back.
"No, it's okay, go,"
she would mutter grimly into his neck, as if her submersion in Lake Michigan were an ordeal she was required to endure for some greater good. Ted tried different ways of making it easier for her, going in little by little, or plunging straight in. But always Sasha would gasp in pain and tighten the grip of her legs and arms around him. When it was over, when she was in, she was herself again, dog paddling despite his efforts to teach her the crawl.
"I know how to swim,"
she would say, impatiently.
"I just don't like to."
Splashing him, teeth chattering gamely. But the entire process unsettled Ted, as if he were hurting her, forcing this immersion upon his niece when what he longed to do, fantasized about doing, was rescue her. Wrap her in a blanket and secrete her from the house before dawn. Paddle away in an old rowboat he'd found. Carry her down the beach and not turn around. He was 25. He trusted no one else. But he could do nothing, really, to protect his niece, and as the weeks eked away, he began to anticipate summer's end as a black, ominous presence. Yet when the time came, it was strangely easy. Sasha clung to her mother, barely glancing at Ted as he loaded up his car and said goodbye, and he set off feeling angry at her, wounded in a way he knew was childish but couldn't seem to help. And when that feeling passed, it left him exhausted, too tired even to drive. He parked outside a Dairy Queen and slept.
"How do I know you know how to swim if you won't show me?"
he asked Sasha once, as they sat on the sand.
"I took lessons with Rachel Costanza."
"You're not answering my question."
She smiled at him a little helplessly, as if she longed to hide behind her childishness, but sensed that, somehow, it was already too late for that.
She has a Siamese cat named Feather.
Why won't you swim?
Oh, Uncle Teddy, she said, in one of her eerie imitations of her mother. You wear me out.
Sasha arrived at his hotel at 8 o'clock, wearing a short red dress, black patent leather boots, and a regalia of cosmetics that sharpened her face into a small, shrill mask. Her narrow eyes curved like hooks. Ted glimpsed her across the lobby and felt reluctance verging on paralysis. He had hoped, cruelly, that she wouldn't show up. Still, he made himself cross the lobby and take her arm.
There's a good restaurant up the street, he said. Unless you have other ideas.
She did. Blowing smoke from the window of a taxi, Sasha harangued the driver in halting Italian as the car shrieked down alleys and the wrong way up one-way streets to the Vomero, an affluent neighborhood Ted had not seen. It was high on a hill. Reeling, he paid the driver and stood with Sasha in a gap between two buildings. The flat, sparkling city arrayed itself before them, lazily towing the sea. Hockney, Ted thought. Diebenkorn. John Moore. In the distance, Mount Vesuvius reposed benignly. Ted pictured the slightly different version of Susan standing near him, taking it in.
This is the best view in Naples, Sasha said, challengingly,
but Ted sensed her waiting, gauging his approval.
It's a wonderful view,
he assured her, and added, as they ambled among the leafy residential streets,
this is the prettiest neighborhood I've seen in Naples.
I live here, Sasha said, a few streets over. Ted was skeptical.
I should have met you up here then. Saved you the trip.
I doubt you would have found it, Sasha said. Foreigners are helpless in Naples.
Most of them get robbed.